Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. If you tuned in because you wanted to be calmed down or not alarmed, you probably should log off right now, because last week I was kind of alarmed at how alarmed Bill Kristol was, and now I'm just alarmed with what's going on here. I will be honest with you. You look around the where we're at here. My newsletter headline today is America Under Siege, and where do you start? The fact that there's going to be the largest armed protest ever to take place on American soil in Washington, D.C., allegedly on January 17th. It's not just Washington. FBI saying there'll be protests in all 50 capitals. They're actually boarding up the windows at the state capitol in Madison. The national monuments are closed. Park Service said on Monday they've closed the Washington Monument through January 24th. Due to continuing threats from the groups that were involved in the pro-Trump riot. The Army Secretary has apparently told a Democratic congressman that at least 25 domestic terrorism cases have been opened, and told him that long guns, Molotov cocktails, explosive devices, and zip ties were all recovered as a wide-ranging investigation unfurls. Nation's capital is being flooded with troops. 15,000 National Guard members could be deployed for the inauguration. House Democrats were briefed on a number of terrifying plots to overthrow the government, including one that apparently is the most concerning, would involve insurrectionists forming a perimeter around the Capitol, the White House, and the Supreme Court, and then trying to block Democrats from entering the Capitol, perhaps even killing them, so that Republicans could take control of the government. This is from the Huffington Post. And we're just beginning to understand how close we came to catastrophe last week. And our guest today is NBC's Ben Collins, and he was on MSNBC the other day, and he freaked me out. This is what Ben had to say then.
I think an important thing to understand here is that there were two different kinds of people at this rally. There were Proud Boys, militiamen, oath keepers who stormed to the front with the idea that they would, you know, wreak havoc, cause violence, maybe arrest, maybe kill some lawmakers. That was the point for those people. Other people, if you're in the QAnon world, in that universe, you thought you were going into the Capitol and you were storming it for Donald Trump. You thought you were receiving orders from him once you got inside the Capitol. And that's what was happening with a lot of those QAnon people. They were in there waiting for more orders. The guy with the zip ties, there were posts for weeks beforehand in the QAnon world about arresting these lawmakers and then bringing them to justice on behalf of Donald Trump. And they explicitly talked about zip ties. They were makeshift handcuffs for the lawmakers if they got to the right part of the Capitol. I don't think people understand how close we were here. This was close to a mass casualty event involving members of Congress, and it's incredibly dangerous. That's what people are talking about. In QAnon, there's this thing called the Great Awakening. And in the Great Awakening, all of the lawmakers are arrested, rounded up, and executed in a public forum. And that's what this was to a lot of these people. They thought that this was about to happen.
Jesus. NBC's Ben Collins joins us. Ben, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm sorry that it came to this, but thank you for having me.
You can find Ben's work at NBC, NBC.com. You are the chief reporter on the dystopian beat. This is your beat, dystopia.
Yeah, I put that as my bio 5 years ago on Twitter when I started covering disinformation as a joke, and it is not a joke anymore. It's absolutely the case.
No, it's not a joke, and I'm so glad we have you on today, because I was thinking today that now it's not like disinformation is part of our politics. Disinformation and the big lie is our politics and has led us to the brink. So I'm just going to throw you the question. I think I know what you're going to say, but how alarmed should we be right now? There were people who thought that it was going to be over after January 6th, or assumed that because of the shock of the murder of a police officer that would be enough, but it's not over at all. How alarmed should we be, Ben Collins?
I think we should be pretty alarmed. I don't want to be alarmist. That's the thing. And I do think that with this level of scrutiny, you can help to thwart the attacks in the future. This was a security failure on January 6th for reasons that we're going to have to find out as a country why that took place. Is that a bureaucratic reason? Was it intentional from people involved in the government? We don't know. But now there seems to be some consensus that should never happen again, which is very helpful. My worry, of course, is, this is lonely people who are attracted to these movements, who are attracted to militia movements, to QAnon, to magical answers about taking out the top of the government, then everything will be fine. And those people don't need to coordinate. They just need to have some level of skill with bomb making or weaponry or something. And that's the worry. Those people traditionally work as lone wolves by themselves. They don't need marches or rallies. They need themselves. And that's in the future. That should be a huge focus, but there's so many things going around right now about specific rallies and specific threats and targets that I'm worried that even if one of them breaks through, then, you know, one is too many.
What happened last Wednesday didn't surprise you, did it? Because I saw that you had been tweeting out and you'd been writing. I told you before we started the podcast, sometimes I got the sense that you were just trying to, you know, yell into the void, grab everybody by the lapels and say, people, you need to understand what's going on here. You need to understand how these QAnon crazy conspiracy theories are infecting everything that is happening right now, the way that the fever swamps are overflowing. So tell me what the buzz was. What was going on Twitter, on Parler, on, you know, the Donald.com and everything before this? What did you see coming?
So for the month before January 6th, there was this feeling, and it was sort of rounded out into a nice sentence that QAnon people would say, which was the military is the only option. They would say this for about a month. They were also urging Donald Trump to cross the Rubicon, which is a Julius Caesar reference to the Rubicon River, where it would effectively kick off a civil war, start a dictatorship on behalf of Donald Trump. These were like known hashtags in the QAnon community, mostly driven by the guy who runs 8kun, named Ron Watkins. It's a guy who lives in Japan, runs a site out of the Philippines, and he probably is Q from QAnon. And he runs these disinformation operations with no regard for what happens at the end of them. So this was happening for a month, and they realized sooner than other sort of duped people that this wasn't going to end through some sort of electoral college procedure, that this was going to end positively for them through violence or through some sort of civil war. So they were ramping up well before the 6th, and they were pushing for these rallies, and they were talking about violence. They were talking about how the only way to really move forward is to replace the government. So, you know, when I was watching on January 6th, my worry, you know, I called my colleague Brandi Zdrazi, who covers what I cover. Mm-hmm. And I was watching this, and I just called her, and we sat in silence on the phone together for about 10 minutes. And I was saying, this is storm and they don't know it. You know, the storm in the QAnon world is the mass arrest and execution of every Democrat. And I was like, man, we're live streaming. We're about to live stream on television the most grisly event in American history.
You thought somebody might be killed.
Yeah. I mean, we were really close. There's that cop, Eugene Goodman, who's mm-hmm. getting, who there should be a statue for this guy right now. You know, he led these people away from Congress. He led them away from all the people they wanted to, you know, kidnap and all this stuff. People brought zip ties to at least temporarily, you know, detain these Congress people. And he led them away from it single-handedly. It's one cop. There's video of it. You can see it. Look him up. It's like bravery in the truest sense. And, you know, I thought that's where we were headed. And I didn't think anybody really knew that that's where we were headed. So people were very angry. And look, you know, the QAnon people have been waiting for that moment for years. They've been waiting to have their prophecy fulfilled on behalf of the president. And they've been waiting for the president to say this sentence, the storm is coming, or the storm is here. And he didn't say it, but they still stormed the Capitol anyway, and they were waiting for orders. And that's really what was going on that day.
I want to get to the moment, but the role of the president, but as you had pointed out before this event took place, that a lot of the things that Trump and his supporters were saying in public was straight out of QAnon. So they may not have heard the phrase the storm, but that much of what Republicans were saying about the election, much of the kind of conspiracy theories we heard from the folks like Sidney Powell, was straight from the fever swamps. And in a lot of ways, the alt-right had become the mainstream right. The fringes had become what the Republican Party, or at least the Trumpian Republican Party, had become. So, you know, they had to hear their words and ideas echoed from the White House itself. Is that an overstatement?
Yeah, you know, a big missed news cycle here, which was, it's fair. It was Christmas. But, you know, in the days around Christmas, two prominent QAnon figures were meeting with the president to decide what to do next. Mike Flynn, who literally took an oath to QAnon, and Sidney Powell, whose whole thing is the storm, and her whole branding is about the storm. Those two people met with the president in the White House in the weeks before January 6th. And Lynn Wood as well, you know, who was filing these insane lawsuits about Stop the Steal. He was talking about how there was secret tape of John Roberts, performing sexual acts on children and all of this wild, insane stuff, which is just raw QAnon. There's no way around that. And that sort of thing pervaded in those spaces. It took over lots of parts of pro-Trump blogs all throughout the internet, like the Gateway Pundit, places like that. And that overtook traditional news in that world. And that's the scary part to me, is that the disconnect from reality got extremely severe over the month and a half after the election, because people were running out of legal and realistic options. So their talking points became ridiculous. They became complete fantasies.
And yet, you still had most Republicans, at least in the House of Representatives, continuing to refuse to accept the results of the election. I was just looking at a piece where Steve Scalise was on one of the cable shows, and was asked, "Well, will you acknowledge Joe Biden's win after the Electoral College votes on December 14th?" And he refused to commit himself. So we still had the bulk of the Republican Party refusing to acknowledge the legitimacy of this election up until, well, even after last Wednesday's storm.
Well, yeah, that's the thing that I'll never be able to sort of square, is that these people were taking, the Ted Cruz types were taking relatively intellectual stances on this stuff based on information that was completely bonkers. You know, they were saying, like, we can't, like, there's been so much fraud. They were saying that as if this was a commonly accepted fact. But the things that they were referencing were Lynn Wood lawsuits and Sidney Powell lawsuits. Right. You know, they were referencing QAnon stuff, but they were saying it in such abstract and sort of given notions that you didn't even need to know if these people were into QAnon. It didn't matter. It sort of got subsumed into the talking points of the Republican Party, despite them being QAnon-based theories and facts. They weren't branded that way, so they didn't have to say it. But the information was, you know, conspiratorial and from 8kun and from 4chan.
This is such a huge point, Ben, is that when you had people like, for example, my home state senator, you know, Ron Johnson, saying, well, we're just asking questions because we have millions of people who you know, have doubts about the election. What they were doing is basically saying, because there had been so many lies out there, so much disinformation, so many Q-sponsored or Q-tainted or Q-adjacent conspiracy theories out there, that now we have to take them seriously and do something about it. So there was a, even though it's kind of laundered through some of their rhetoric, that's the through line, isn't it, of everything that's happened?
Yeah. I mean, years ago, I jokingly called it the human centipede of bad information. There was this way stuff would get from 4chan to Fox News and the president within a day, because it would get laundered, right? You know, and at no place down that chain was somebody really breaking ranks or breaking some sort of editorial line. So basically what it would do is you'd start a rumor on 4chan. It would be an anonymous poster on 4chan just saying, you know, I hear this thing is happening. That thing would get aggregated to Reddit. And then, you know, InfoWars would take something from Reddit, but not 4chan. So it would go to InfoWars. And then from InfoWars, the guy at the Gateway Pundit would say, okay, it's on InfoWars, it might be true. Then since it's on the Gateway Pundit, an aggregator, like back in the day, Drudge would take it and explode that. Ooh, then it would go super viral on Twitter. Then the president would see it, or Fox would see it. And they would say—
And talk radio would pick it up.
Talk radio. And they would say, I don't know, I don't know if this is true, but we're hearing this thing. Mm-hmm. And then it would sort of like have a feedback loop where the guy on 4chan who made this up would be like, I don't know, am I onto something? The president just said the thing that I made up 6 hours ago. So maybe I'm onto something. Maybe we need to keep diving on this. And then eventually it sort of creates a reality of its own, even though it was created in a basement a day ago.
Oh my God. So going back to your point about how close we were to a mass casualty event, and you were talking about the security guard who led the protesters away from the Senate door, it seems obvious to me, though, how close they came to not just committing acts of violence, but to succeeding in derailing the whole presidential election process. So, for example, if they had broken in and taken some senators hostage, or taken a state House of Representative member hostage, or killed anyone, or even just, you know, held them prisoner, it seems extremely unlikely that the Congress would have been able to go ahead with the vote and the certification. They could have. They came very close to delaying, derailing the entire constitutional process. Do you agree?
Yes. Yeah. And that's why they did what they did. They found the loophole, which was violence. And that's the scary part, is they knew that this is the end game. Look, I know everyone focuses on the QAnon shaman, the guy with the horns and the pelt. Right. And everyone's like, oh, look at how silly this is. These people were unserious. And yeah, there were some unserious people there. It actually served as very good cover for the rest of them, because there were people there who knew exactly what they were doing, who were wearing fatigues, had walkie-talkies, busted through with very specific instruments that they knew could get through lines of defense. And they were working together. And, you know, the people around them, there was a cacophony of insane people who are very, like I said, very silly people. But those people got wrapped up in it, too. Because once you think, you know, you've been told this whole time that the government was going to be overthrown on behalf of Donald Trump. Although you may have been silly about it previously, once you're in the middle of it, you're in the middle of it. You know, once you drew a hard line once you entered that Capitol. So you were serving as sort of an infantry to these pretty skilled militiamen who had busted through with the intent of doing this precise thing, which was at least delaying the election and maybe overturning it.
We got a glimpse of how dangerous it could be when there were the arrests of nearly a dozen men involved in the plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, maybe kidnap and murder her. And these guys may have been crazy, but they were serious. They were very serious. And yet it seems as if we as a country didn't really internalize the nature of the threat. It didn't cause anyone to lower the temperature or to be more careful about the rhetoric. I mean, that should have been one of the big warnings. And of course, you have Gabriel Sterling in Georgia come out and say, Mr. President, you need to stop saying these things. Someone will get killed. Someone is going to get shot. And yet nothing happened. There was no reaction to it.
Well, Charlie, I mean, I want to know from you, because the way I reacted to the Whitmer thing when all of that stuff came out after the fact, where they, you know, first we heard that there was a plan generally, and then we heard that there was a plan specifically to kidnap the governor and to it's still unclear what the game plan was after that. But my, you know, Charlie, did you think that was hilarious? Because I thought it was funny.
No.
At the time. Okay, interesting.
Not at all.
I thought, what did they think they were going to do? Were they going to become the governor themselves? Like, what was the next step, right? So I think a lot of people thought that was just a funny outcome, that these people thought they could personally overturn a state government. So I think that's why people didn't take that seriously. You see the mugshots of these people. They are not, they didn't look like geniuses that could overthrow a government, right? And I think that that's what this was, is that, you know, people view this as podunk or not, you know, people who cannot pull off a genuine insurgency. But when you have these kinds of numbers, and when you have people who are trained in this stuff, and you use that as a test run, eventually it's not unserious at all. It's very serious.
And they have guns, and it doesn't take a lot of guys with guns to do very bad things. Okay, so let's go back to the whole question of the incitement, because in President Trump's role. I personally think it's a mistake to focus just on his remarks on Wednesday, right before the event. I mean, clearly he was egging them on. Clearly he wanted them to go. Clearly he was targeting Mike Pence. But there's this larger pattern of that you've described, of the incitement, the spreading of the big lie, the ginning up of anger and, you know, sense of conspiracy theory. So give me your sense on what was the president's role about what happened last Wednesday, and what is happening right now with the sort of the country on edge, wondering, is there going to be violence?
you know, January 6th was the date circled for him to take back the election. Yeah. And in the days before, you know, there it wasn't clear even what he was saying or what he was talking about, even to the people showing up. The people who showed up to that rally didn't know what was going to happen. They thought that there was going to be, you know, if you watch the people in on those extremist forums as the speech was going on, they were like, this guy's talking about Oprah. Like, I thought he was going to have the goods about overturning the election. What's going on?
So they genuinely thought that he was going to have the goods. They sincerely believed that he was going to do a dump of this amazing evidence.
Yeah. And why wouldn't they? Because he had kept saying, see you on January 6th, both on Twitter and his speeches. In fact, the Wi-Fi password for the press at his event in Georgia, where he was campaigning for Perdue and Loeffler, the Wi-Fi password was see you January 6th with an exclamation point at the end of it. Huh. So this was a weeks-long propaganda campaign to say that, you know, something was going to happen on the 6th. That's the other thing, too. If he had left and they didn't storm the Capitol, what a letdown for those people, right? Those people flew all throughout the country because he said something was going to happen on January 6th. And, you know, he gave the only marching orders in that speech were go march in the Capitol. The only orders that he had was that. And it's not, like, as these people were not going to just go march in the Capitol and just stay there on the outside and just yell at them. That wouldn't have accomplished a thing other than intimidation. So he had built this up as some sort of, you know, earth-shattering event. So have people all throughout that ecosystem. You know, Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA said he bussed in 80 different buses of people, and that today was going to be one of the most consequential days in American history. That was the sort of talk. They were talking about it as 1776, one of the largest hashtags on Twitter the night before was 1776. If you go by the numbers, that's from numbers from the Network Contagion Research Institute. It was 1776 was one of the biggest hashtags in the MAGA ecosystem the night before. These people thought they were doing the revolution. That's what they thought was happening.
Yeah, okay. In their ecosystem, what does 1776 mean? Does it mean revolution? Does it mean violent revolution?
It means what you want it to mean. That plausible deniability is the heart of this entire day, this entire ecosystem. You know, you can take it to mean that the storm is coming, which would absolutely suffice for revolution, right? If you're, you know, beheading Democrats en masse on public television. But you can also take it to mean something symbolic. And that's how you get, you know, teachers and CEOs and, you know, regular members of society flying across the country to go to this rally as a last stand. These people are doing a symbolic last stand, and they got caught up in a genuine insurrection.
Okay, in the category of how alarmed should we be, there's at least anecdotal information about members of the Secret Service, of the military, of the Capitol Police, who were sympathetic with, if not accomplices, to what happened. So right now, how concerned should we be about QAnon-friendly folks in the National Guard, in the U.S. Army, in the Secret Service, in these other security forces?
You know, my worry is that there are just more of these people than we think or can know. During the pandemic, we saw so many groups of people fall down that specific rabbit hole, in part because QAnon supporters were so rabid in their evangelism during that time, and nobody else was rabid in their evangelism. Everyone else was freaked out, and there was no plan, and the world was falling apart, right? And in the QAnon world, it wasn't. In the QAnon world, everything was going to plan, right? They were saying, hey, don't worry about this. This is the pandemic. First of all, it's not that real. It's a new world order thing. But Second of all, you can get your life back very quickly. Like, you can go hug your grandparents and not feel bad about it, because not only is the pandemic not real, but Donald Trump has it all in hand. It's all fine. He's taking out all of the bad guys, all of the evil guys for us. So that recruitment on social media, both in pro-Trump forums, but also in wellness spaces, in healing groups on Facebook and Instagram, it recruited more Trump supporters from disparate alternative lifestyles into that space. So it's not just cops and Secret Service and, you know, gruff pro-Trump dudes. It's all levels of society. And I think we got to figure out where those people came from and how many there are. We really don't know. The polling on this is all over the place. It could be, you know, the low estimates are in the high hundred thousands. The high estimates are in the, you know, tens of millions. We got to figure out how many people really believe in this stuff. I'm not saying, I don't know what the next plan is in terms of like getting these people out of that mindset, but we have to first quantify this and see how many are serious about the violent parts of it. And then we can work backwards from there.
So what was the reaction in this world to what happened on Wednesday? Were people horrified? Were they energized? Did they think that this was the, you know, the first shots of 1776? What was the reaction that you got in the first few days after this happened?
There were several reactions. I think the only positive thing that came out of this is that people who were just pro Trump for regular reasons, you know, taxes or something like that, that was the last straw for a lot of people. I really do believe that. And I've seen that in my life. I've seen it around me. But in the extremist world, there were two reactions. One, it was, you know, this was Antifa. This was a staged op. This was all done on a green screen, you know, standard InfoWars stuff that eschews responsibility for the idea that this, that, you know, years of violent talk could lead to violent action. So honestly, that is a healthier response than the other response, because that response makes it so you are against violence and you couldn't possibly be a part of a movement that killed a cop. The other response is the scary part, where militias and people who are more committed to taking down the government than they are committed to Donald Trump were upset that it wasn't successful. In fact, a lot of the people after the middle of the night Donald Trump video where he effectively concedes, those people were like, okay, so Donald Trump isn't the guy. You know, he wasn't the guy standing up for us all along. We're on our own now.
So they were disillusioned. They felt betrayed by him.
They felt betrayed by Donald Trump. And those are the people on websites like 4chan and the Donald.win, where they're, you know, they are still planning for the future. Those are the people who are behind this million militia march and these other scary big events in the future, who believe that, you know, the government is, again, it's run to them by, at the very least, criminals, at, you know, at the worst, child eaters. And they just need to be taken down at all costs. And that's the split right now. You get the people who don't believe it could be them, and they're coming up with ludicrous excuses to deflect blame, or people who have quadrupled down and don't even need the leader of their movement anymore.
Well, talk to me also about the relationship with police officers and law enforcement. This was a movement that through much of the summer was all about law and order, backing the blue, Blue Lives Matter. And then, of course, we have the event where a police officer is murdered. How does that tension work? How does it play out? Are there good cops and bad cops? And you want us, you know, if you're a good cop, you're going to join us. If you're not a good cop, we're going to shoot you. What? I mean, how does it work?
It's extraordinarily complicated. I would say it's nuanced, but there's not like, you know, it doesn't really actually make sense. The internal logic doesn't make sense. So a big part of this movement is the Boogaloo movement, which is inherently anti-cop because they're anti-state. And those people have been sort of driving the ship in the extremist side for a while now. Those people just hate cops. They've always hated cops. You know, they go into Black Lives Matter protests and they try to blow stuff up because the point is to end the state, and they target what they call alphabet boys, which is like the ATF, the FBI. They target plainclothes cops too. Those people were in that rally as well. They are an outsized part of this movement, despite being the antithesis of the rest of the movement, you know? But a lot of people have become anti-cop since this happened because of Ashley Babbitt, who is the QAnon supporter who was shot trying to break through a door that would have led her directly to congresspeople and Mike Pence. And they have martyred this person just straight up. And because of that, the person who shot them was a cop, and it has radicalized them against cops since then, because they believe, you know, the cops could be part of this deep state now, right? They can fold that pretty neatly. They can fold the Secret Service very neatly. into a deep state conspiracy theory. So that's what's going on there.
So since all this happened, we've had some dramatic developments on social media. Twitter actually bans Donald Trump, which is amazing. In the last couple of days, they, at least what I've read, is that they've eliminated about 70,000 accounts that were linked to QAnon. And of course, now Parler's been shut down. So first of all, what took social media so long to realize that this stuff was potentially dangerous? This, we've been debating this. We've been talking about this. This has been going on for a very, very long time. A lot of people thought that Twitter would never, ever, ever ban the president of the United States, but they did. So what took so long?
They knew this, something like this could happen. I've talked to people at Twitter and Facebook and Instagram for years. They realized that this was a possibility. And I don't know why it took this long specifically for this to be the final straw. They always work. They never work preventatively. They always work on battle. This time they are, they took a hammer instead of a scalpel this time, and it has clearly made a difference.
Okay, I want to get to that, whether it's made a difference or not. I mean, obviously on the right, you're getting a lot of, victim playing, which is that this is an attack on free speech. This is an attack on the First Amendment. It's not the First Amendment because it's not state action. But what was going on between Wednesday and the time when everybody decided to shut down Parler? Now, for people who aren't aware of this, Parler is sort of the right wing, right-wing version of Twitter, where they had no standards, no moderation really whatsoever, and where a lot of right-wing folks went because they thought they were going to be censored on Twitter. So, but Parler was sort of the back alley of social media there for a while, wasn't it? I mean, there's worse there, but what were you seeing on Parler that led the other media companies to basically kill them, at least for now?
So there are two things at play here. The content side and sort of how things work in terms of moderation decisions. So the content side with Parler, the site had devolved into sort of an aggregator for the dumbest stuff on 4chan and the Donald.win in a way that served itself as a feed instead of just, just a laundry list of conspiracy theories like it is on 4chan. So it was, basically it normified all of the wildest conspiracy theories that were going on in the days after January 6th. So that's why it became so dangerous, I think, is that it was getting to a much wider audience conspiracy theories that were otherwise relegated strictly to 4chan. But in terms of why it happened then, I will say that in the days after January 6th, I'd never seen that kind of internal pressure at places like Twitter to take this down. There were, I was leaked internal Slack messages by people at Twitter, and there were a lot of people saying, like, look, I was in the camp of he's the president, we can't take down this account, he deserves to have an account, for years. And they said, the quote was, I think fomenting a coup is a bright line to draw. So yeah,
I think so.
And killing people. So by Friday there was this massive meeting at Twitter where they said, look, it's hard to work here, where this guy is using our platform as a weapon. We don't have to do this. We got to get him off. And by the end of the day, Donald Trump's account was gone. And then what happens in that space is that there's sort of a cascade. People sort of follow each other's leads here. Twitter always follows Facebook, or Facebook follows Twitter. And then Amazon followed those people, which would at that point, Apple, Google, Twitter, and Facebook, in trying to get Parler offline.
And Parler is completely offline, at least for now, until they find some different servers. One of the leading figures in Parler is Dan Bongino, who is one of the crackpot, is he a talk radio host, occasional commentator on Fox. This is Dan Bongino complaining and or whining about what happened to Parler the other day on Fox.
Understand, we were wiped out. Listen to me, America. We were wiped out. I've been texting with Brian all weekend. And what did you say? Every text was like, Apple? Question mark. Yep, Apple. Then Brian would text me, Google too? Yep, Brian, Google. Then he texts me next, Amazon too? Yep. That was my answer to him every time. I have not slept all weekend. They've effectively tried to bankrupt me and my investors on Parler. And you know what? They won. And to all the geniuses out there, too, saying, oh, this is a private company. It's not a First Amendment fight. Really? It's not? Read the Wall Street Journal op-ed today about Marsh versus Alabama, where a so-called private town tried to restrict access to religious materials and lost because they were a de facto government. You know what? These companies are more powerful than a de facto government. You know what?
Yeah, well, whatever. So this is what confuses me a little bit, Ben. Trump and a lot of folks on the right want to get rid of Section 230. 230 basically says we're not going to hold you accountable for anything that's on your site, right? I mean, it gives it means you can't be sued for somebody who says something libelous, slanderous, or whatever. In fact, if you did do that, that would shut them down even faster, wouldn't it? I mean,
oh yeah, they would have been gone. All of these people would have been gone a long time ago. In part because if 230 is gone, if you can sue Twitter for what's posted on their platform, there's actually more incentive to do it, right? So, say MAGA Patriot 420 or whatever says something libelous about me, that I eat kids or something, right?
Yeah.
I could sue that guy, but, getting that guy's Ford F-150 is not really high on my priority list of like the things that I want to get in my life, spend my life doing, suing a man, getting all these legal fees. But if I can sue, MAGA Patriot 420 and Twitter, for propagating this thing that got 40,000 retweets, then I win. I would definitely win that fight. It's the mother load, right? So Twitter in that case is disincentivized from even hosting that account ever. So that guy is no longer on that platform. It doesn't make any sense for Twitter to host somebody like Donald Trump, who consistently spews libelous stuff about all of his political enemies. So
I'm not sure he understood that.
No, he didn't. And I think it would have made the lives of people at Twitter and Facebook harder, which was probably what he was told, and he probably wanted to get some vengeance there. But it would have made his life impossible. It would have put him in this exact position that he's in right now, but 2 or 3 years ago.
Well, I want to get to that in a moment. So the anger, though, is building out there. There's no question about it, that it has not gone away. So the latest talking point that we're getting from Republicans is that, yes, we have, fueled these conspiracy theories. Yes, we've either propagated these big lies. Many of us voted to actually overturn the election. Some of us signed on to a completely mendacious lawsuit that would have reversed the election. But now it's time to heal. And if you go ahead with impeachment, there might be violence. And you're sort of getting this. This is Brian Kilmeade from Fox essentially saying it's crazy to go ahead with impeachment because people out there are having these protests and there could be blood. Brian Kilmeade.
We believe that America could be more effective and has been ineffective because we've been at each other's throats. What could be more disenchanting?
They don't want him to run again. They don't want him to run again.
They don't want him to run again. That's fine. But you don't understand, too, there's a lot of people that want him to, number one, continue to be a force in the Republican Party, believe a lot what he believes. He has 75 million supporters. So if you have an overarching sense that I got to bring the country together because we see what's happening around this country, how 50 state houses are being threatened on Inauguration Day, this is the last thing you want to do. It astounds me that now Chuck Schumer, guys, is exploring a possible workaround using the authority granted to two senators back in 2004 to reconvene the Senate in times of emergency, I assume this, and have a quick impeachment vote. Fantastic idea. Mitch McConnell has to sign off on it. But it would be as dumb as Nancy Pelosi hopping on 60 Minutes last night and saying the president's an imminent threat.
Well, that's
and
not
going to
happen.
Mitch
McConnell said.
Okay, so that kind of sounds like a threat, or at least the implication being there. You don't want to do this because you'll make us mad now and that there might be more violence.
Yeah, the whiplash, if you're watching this network, must be so profound. Last week you were told that Antifa did it and we must bring them all to justice and all of them. And then 2 days later, we're like, okay, we got to bring country together to heal. We can't just forget about all the stuff we did last month and a half in this network. We must come together as one country and move past this for the next 9-10 days.
Yeah,
I don't know how you square the circle. In fact, I would like to talk to somebody who watched Fox and see if they watched it every day, see if they feel a little betrayed because everything they were told, they were told like four or five different stories on four or five different days. now we're at this, we must come together and heal thing. It seems like they're settling on this as a, as an idea. Look, it's up to Democrats. They want to impeach this guy, but you know, the narrative is not clear yet. Like the narrative about why he shouldn't be impeached. I still haven't heard why that is yet.
Well, and but you are getting these reports of the congressman saying that the level of anger and threats is actually rising, that there is clearly an intent to intimidate. So here's the basic question that I really wanted to get to all along. So it does feel like we've had this moment of reckoning now. We realize what the stakes are. We realize what the threat is. We have Twitter shutting down the president and many of the QAnon folks. We have Parler being shut down. We have Cumulus Radio, which owns a bunch of conservative talk radio stations and employs people like Mark Levin and Dan Bongino, saying, you got to stop lying about the election. So I guess the question is, does this actually make a difference, Ben? Or does this simply shove the fever swamp into different shadows? Does this actually change the media ecosystem in a meaningful way?
It's a really good question. It really relies on how good and persistent people are at finding the lies that they want to be fed. I do think that over the last 5 years, 10 years really on social media, the lie was the thing that was the easiest thing to find. You would be fed that and it would feel the best, by the way. You would be fed that on Facebook through an algorithm that you didn't even know you were a part of. And you would get this lie that would make you feel great instantly.
Why does the lie feel better? Why do you get more dopamine hits out of lies than out of truth?
Sure.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, there's two major reasons. One, fear is an exciting prospect. You know, the idea that there is a group of bad guys that are out there personally bringing you down and that they can be defeated. That's a movie, you know,
it's drama.
Exactly. And it enraptures you. And that's what happened with QAnon. Basically, it's like, there's an end game. There's the end of the movie. And when you saw people in the Capitol waiting around, milling about, waiting for instructions from the president, you know, they were waiting for the next scene in the movie. They just didn't know that they were in the movie. They were characters in the movie now. Yeah.
So if the lies are the dopamine hit, it's sort of like lies as crack or as drug. And so the question is, does this make a difference? And it really does depend on how much people want to go get their next hit, right? And there are still sites out there that where they can get the stuff, right?
Yeah, and I think that's really the First Amendment thing that makes sense here. You can find it. It's not hard. Parler is complaining about being banished from the internet. There actually are hosting providers that will take them on, like Epic, which hosts Gab, Vanwatech, which hosts all manner of terrible websites. People will be able to find that. It'll just be harder for them to get to it. Like that's just the case. And that's the way speech used to work before we had Facebook and Twitter, where everyone had this 100% level playing field. That really wasn't 100% level playing field. It was really sort of like tilted towards fear and paranoia. So, once they're not mainlining it anymore, maybe there's this thing called exogenous shock, where if you're kind of like removed from your environment, you can kind of see better what you were taking in, regardless. That could be information, that could be food, that could be all sorts of things. Maybe those people can go through that shock and be like, was that really healthy? I was sitting on Facebook all day just thinking about Hillary Clinton. Was that really a good way to spend my life? We might go through that in the next few months.
I would hope that that's the case, because there's two alternatives that I can see is that what you've done is you've shoved these, you've shoved the disinformation and the conspiracy theories over to the fringes so that you've isolated them. That would be the best case scenario. The other unfortunate option is that the fringes then get a much bigger audience and become more like a mainstream. So that in fact, rather than killing off those folks, what happens is that you wake up 6 months from now and OAN has higher ratings than Fox News or Newsmax or something. I mean, the Newsmax is out there, and that Gab has become the new Twitter. We just don't know what's going to happen, do we?
No, we don't. That's the worry is, if these people build the infrastructure that is parallel, that could be very dangerous. But it takes lots of time and money and effort, and those parallel infrastructures. If, like, for example, if Section 230 is repealed in that environment, there are a lot of problems for somebody trying to build a parallel infrastructure there. So, you know, it's possible that could happen, but really this is something that even law enforcement, like the FBI, has been thinking about for a long time with other kinds of extremist groups. This is when you talk about ISIS, this is what you talk about when you talk about deplatforming and all this stuff. There were people in the FBI who thought, you know, maybe we should leave the ISIS propaganda. Maybe we should allow them to post in these sites where we know where they are. And we know the people being recruited there. It's the whole, there are two minds here. Do you let people propagate this stuff and allow law enforcement to track these people? See it all in the open, understand what's going on? Or do you pen them in, allow them to live in this space where everything is wrong? The entire thing is violent. The entire thing is toxic. And people are rooting each other on to commit terror attacks. And while that group is smaller, it's much harder to track and it's much harder to diffuse. Right now, we're moving towards the second thing. We'll see what's better now. We're about to see what's going to happen.
So the president today, while you and I are speaking, is headed off to Alamo, Texas, not the Alamo, but Alamo, Texas, on the border, where he's going to be touting his wall, the Great Wall that Mexico didn't pay for. So I've seen a lot of speculation online that people are going to, that these folks we've been talking about are going to read that, see the president at the Alamo or at Alamo, Texas, and that is kind of a signal to them in some way. So give me your take on that. The president of the United States in Alamo.
I mean, the people who are looking at symbolism in everything, including misspelled tweets and stuff, this is a gold mine, right?
Yeah, very much so.
QAnon people read into typos in his tweets and say, like, if you replace this letter with this thing, that means he's secretly doing this. The Alamo or Alamo, Texas is, you know, a very direct reference to a last name. So that's going to happen regardless.
You think that that's one of the reasons why he's there? I mean, I don't want to get
in. Yeah, of course.
You do. I see. I'm questioning myself going, okay, am I spending too much time looking at this stuff? Am I thinking like this, that I'm going, damn, the president is going down to Alamo now with everything going on?
We are all subject to this conspiracy thinking. Yesterday, there was this rumor going around the internet that the Secretary of State's website showed that President Trump was removed from office on that day, and nobody knew about it, and they were announcing it secretly on the Secretary of State's website. And my brain was like, "Well, it's there. How do you explain this?" And I did the whole thing, and I texted one of my colleagues. I was like, "I don't know. Is this happening?" And then 5 minutes later, I was like, "Never mind. I have QAnon brain. I'm sorry. It happened. I think like these people know."
Yeah. you can marinate in it. Well, I think that the one thing that's pretty obvious, or should be obvious to folks, is that it was not going to be over on January 6th. It's not going to be over on January 20th. We are in for a cycle of this. And I'm not sure that most people are prepared for what's going on. We don't want to be alarmist, but I will admit that I'm alarmed at the number of people that have gotten drawn into this. And I will say this, that you have the crazies, you have the conspiracy theorists. I'm also just disturbed about the sincere, people who are not nuts, who somehow honestly in their minds believe the lies they have been told, believe that this election was stolen, believe that the American democracy is at risk. Because at that point, it's understandable, it's almost rational and defensible for them to try to take action to get it back, so that it's not, the culpability is not on them as much as on the people who have misled them. And there have been so many people who have been so willing to mislead them. And I think there will be tens of millions of people for the next 20 years who will believe that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's my worry too. I want everybody to go to this is the terrible advice generally, but I want people to go to a subreddit called QAnon Casualties.
Ooh.
And it will show you, for every person that stormed the Capitol, there are hundreds or if not thousands of families that have just been torn apart by this stuff. And it's because they are not living in reality and they're cutting people off. It's how cults work. It's how abusive relationships work. You know, there was a story last night about a kid who told his school he had COVID so he couldn't come in, and his mom tried to kick him out of the house because she was like, the government is going to come and take us now. And we are living in this constant state of mass paranoia now, in part because it's been sort of in the back of our psyche for years. There's a man on Twitter who can take over our thoughts in any moment with wild conspiracy theories and streams of paranoia. And that has an effect on the populace. And so does all these tiny little other conspiracy theories that popped up over the course of the last 4 or 5 years. You know, there are violent ends to this stuff, but there are also very human heartbreaks that come with it too. We're going to have to, as a country, come together and try to figure out how to fix this through psychology and through just humanity and empathy. And that's going to be the challenge of the next few years.
How long can you keep doing this? Do you know what I mean by this? Yeah. I mean, how long can you every single day read this stuff, know this stuff, spend the time marinating in the crazy? I mean, Ben, you know, you're a young guy, yeah. right? Yeah. I mean, don't you every once in a while have this thing like, you know what, if I have to do this another 6 months, I'm going to lose my freaking mind.
Oh, I say it every day. Okay. But I said that 18 months ago. So maybe I'm just post that level. I don't know. No, I mean, like the thing is, like, you see a lot of humanity in here. You see a lot of people just begging for meaning and like longing for relationship and love. It's really, at the end of the day, that's all this is about. People get a huge feeling of identity, sometimes for the first time in their life, from feeling this stuff.
That's why it's so powerful.
Yeah. And at this point, and I'm sure I get it too, just from trying to report on this stuff. So to help those people who've had their family taken in by this stuff. We're in the middle of this. Is like a, you know, it's become a calling for a lot of people who have had family members go down this path, because they want them back in their lives, and they see that it's happening at an exponential rate from now on. So yeah, it's depressing as hell, man. I'm extremely tired and very sad all the time. But you can, if you want to be one of the people who provides the light right now, you can do it. There is a way to help, and we're going to be on the front lines of something that can provide a really nice, empathetic solution for a lot of these people in the future.
All right. That's a good note to end on. Ben Collins from NBC News. You can find his work on NBCnews.com. Is it NBC.com? NBCnews.com?
NBCnews.com, I think is probably best. Yeah.
NBCnews.com. See him on the air. I really appreciate your work. Has been just fascinating, disturbing, but really fascinating if you want to find out what's going on. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.